a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network, and with me is my co-host and producer associate, Miss Renee Shaker. Renee,
good
welcome.
Good evening. Good evening, Rick.
We have an unusual show for you tonight. Once again, we bring you a set of new voices. We have voices from the Middle East. We call it Arab Summer. You've heard of Arab Spring. Well, this is Arab Summer. We've got Sarab al-Jaqli. Renee, why don't you tell them who Sarab is, or Sarab?
Sarab is a Syrian-American, born in London, but he's both a Syrian national and an American. He does community organizing in the Arab American community here in the U.S., as well as his day job as an advertising executive. He currently serves as president of NAP, which is the Network of Arab American Professionals, and he's focused on empowering the Arab American and Muslim community, basically from the ground up. He also is active in solidarity efforts with the Syrian revolution. And I think he's going to have a lot to say on that topic when he joins us.
We also have Moody Khalil, who is a educator and artist, a doctor from Egypt. We have another doctor, Khalid Al-Sahili, who's an educator in civil engineering, calls us from Nablus. Miss Emily Dillick, who is a publisher of Progressive Press, also a human rights and women's rights activist. Dennis Campbell, a publisher from the UK, he publishes UK Progressive, and also hosts a YouTube channel called Worldview. And also we have Charlotte Cates. Tell them about Charlotte Cates, please.
Charlotte's an activist living up in Vancouver, Canada, and she's active as an organizer in Palestinian solidarity and social justice. She works with a Palestinian prisoner solidarity network and is on the organizing committee of the U.S. campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. She also works with Boycott Israeli Apartheid campaign up in Canada.
Thank you so much. And now a little bit of news. Under the heading of a clock, a stuck clock is right at least twice a day, Congressman Rooney has put out a newsletter, says that he has grave concerns with plans to provide weapons to support to rebels on the ground in Syria. With the knowledge that these rebels have been infiltrated by al-Qaeda, we simply cannot in good conscience provide arms to these groups. We cannot spend American dollars to arm the enemy that attacked us on 9/11, whom we fought for more than a decade and of whom our troops risked their lives fighting to this day. Arming the al-Qaeda-backed rebels directly conflicts with our national security interests. And Congressman Rooney, I got to say, hey, the stuck clock is right at least once. Under the heading of two choices, they do it all the time for consumers in other countries. In the U.S., where food and biotech lobbyists have Congress in their back pockets, more than 80% of processed food contains genetic engineered ingredients. These GMO ingredients are making Monsanto and Big Food rich, and yet they make us sick. And tons of herbicide and pesticides used to grow them are poisoning our soil and water. Food manufacturers make GMO free for consumers in 64 other countries. For one or two reasons, either because consumers in those countries have demanded that GMO be banned from their foods, or simply because consumers have demanded GMO labeling laws. In most cases, rather than label GMOs in their products, food manufacturers have found alternative ingredients. They can have GM food, we can have GM food free. So make sure that you seek out and find free GMO-free food. Wonderful article by Alan Mackey. By the way, those of you who want to see the rest of the news items, please go to averyvoice.com, AVERYVOICE.com. You can get the full background information on the show. Also, another quick news story. Should you be able to buy food directly from farmers? Well, regulators don't think so. Around the country, local farmers are selling meat, dairy products, and other dinner staples directly to neighbors who are increasingly flocking to farms in search of wholesome food, which seem to embody the USDA's advisory, Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. Well, not exactly. USDA and sister food regulator, the FDA, there's a problem. Many of the farmers are distributing food via private contracts like herd shares and leasing arrangements, which fall outside the regulatory system of state and local retail licenses and inspections that govern public food sales. Well, with that, we've got an abbreviated version of the news today. Maybe we can sneak in a section or two later. But don't forget to support your local progressive broadcasters. And with that, I'm going to bring our first guest on. Let's see, we should have here Sarab.
We have Sarab with us. As I mentioned, Sarab is an organizer with the Network of Arab American Professionals. He's a Syrian national. And he's focused on empowering the Arab American and Muslim community from the ground up. He has a particular perspective on Syria, being a Syrian national himself. Sarab, are you with us?
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Wonderful. So glad you could join us.
Thank you for having
Sarab,
me.
Sarab, why don't you start off by giving us your perspective on the turmoil in Israel, in Syria, where this conflict is at right now and how you might see it play out.
Sure. First of all, thank you both for having me today on this Sunday evening. Very happy to be here and talk to all your listeners. Basically, the Syrian revolution has entered its third year. It's been about 28 months of struggle, very costly struggle, that is pitting a popular uprising against a regime that has been in place for about 40 years. And this regime that rules the country, as we know, is headed by the Assad family. And really, at the end of the day, is a mafia that controls and manipulates all resources of the nation. And that's really, at the end of the day, what this struggle is all about. Early on, in the early days of the revolution, in the supporters of the Assad regime, were very frank with their slogans and said, it's either Assad or we burn the country. And what we've seen since then, over the past 3 years, is a concerted policy of overwhelming and sustained violence. And that has led to what UN has called the worst conflict since Rwanda, 1994, and the genocide in Rwanda that occurred. Where we are today, about 30% of the Syrian population has been displaced. Externally, there's probably about close to 2 million Syrian refugees in neighboring countries that have fled. There's probably about 6 million Syrians inside the country who are internally displaced. These are folks who left their homes and had to move from one country, one city, town, neighborhood to the other. This is all in a country of a population of 23 million people. So just to give a little bit of perspective into the utter devastation and the flow of humanity searching for a safe place to take their families. Right now, where we are today is that we're in a situation that the entire world, in my opinion, has been complicit in doing two things. One, extending the suffering of Syrian people, and two, really delaying the outcome and the inevitable outcome, which is the Syrian revolution victory. If you look at the Assad side of the house, for example, he's been utterly supported by Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, militias from Iraq, which have basically served to uphold his position in the country. On the so-called friends of Syria side, and I use the word so-called with air quotations, we have those who are supposedly in support of the revolution, but if you look at the practical support that they've provided, they've really done everything in their power to withhold any tangible assistance for the revolution. And so where we are today, we have monthly 5,000 Syrians being murdered. We have a catastrophe, as we've said, that we haven't seen since Rwanda. Assad probably controls about 40% of the territory. And really, at the end of the day, Assad and his regime is really not a functioning government of Syria any longer. It's just the best armed, well-funded militia with the most external political support.
Sarab, can you... give us a little bit of information on the lay of the land there. I mean, what factions, you mentioned the external factions that are supporting the Assad regime. Sure. Who are the various players involved on both sides of the conflict?
Sure. So at the outset of all of this, we have to look at this conflict at the core as a conflict between the haves and have-nots in the country. Right? You have the regime and the powers that be that run the regime, which is the Assad family on top, and his enduring circles that surround him. And you have those, the majority of the Syrian people, who have not benefited from his rule over the past decades. So that's one. I think if you're going to look at the circle around that in terms of influence in the country, we have to look, as I mentioned earlier, to those who have been putting their hands in the area. And you can look at the regional players and the regional powers, Iran being and Iraq, which pretty much have sided on support of Assad. And you look at other powers that have been supposedly supporting the Free Syrian Army and resistance to the Assad regime in the country, which could be identified as Qatar, Saudi. Then if you want to look into international and politics, you have the Americans and the Russians, who while on surface will basically articulate alternative positions that are confronting one another, in essence, they're basically playing both sides of the same equation and pushing toward a concerted effort of a negotiated outcome that can maintain their joint interests in the country.
Sarab, let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Is it really a bipolar process, or is this multipolar? Are there, you know, at one point we've talked about in terms of haves versus have-nots, the existing power structure versus trying to democratize, maybe get more resources out to the other people. Because of the complex interplay of the nations around there, the power centers, you mentioned that what looks like differences from the outside of Russians supporting the Assad regime versus the Americans, it seemed to be not as much. Is it multipolar, or is it really bipolar haves versus have-nots in your opinion?
It's very complex when you look at Syria as a nation. And the history of Syria as a nation is defined by, pardon me, let me rephrase that. The influence in the Middle East, typically, has been defined by which larger power can control Syria. We've seen that in ancient times. We've seen that in modern times. We saw that, for example, between the competitiveness between Nasser's Egypt and rival factions in Iraq, for example, in the 50s and the 60s and so on and so on. It's just the nature of how power politics plays out in the Middle East. It really revolves around who can take Syria. Now, when we look at today's world, we see things a little bit different. It's no longer just an Arab game internally competing for hearts and minds of the Arab world. We have the Iranian factor, which is a very different kind of dual wild card, which basically at the end of the day has exerted extreme influence in the region vis-a-vis its influence over the ruling government in Iraq. It's obviously long-standing 30-year relationship with the Assad regime and its connection to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Alternatively, this is obviously a frustration to competitive regional players such as Saudi and other Gulf countries as well, who see Iran's growing threat as competitive against their own interests. And I think that's where one level of this conflict is being viewed from. However, if we boil it all down and look into what's actually happening on the ground in Syria, you're going to notice a few things. One is there's really a real foreign influence on the ground. And it's not, as we have discussed for 2.5 years here in progressive circles in America or in the West, something that is being driven by the West nor their allies in the Gulf. It's something that is being driven from day one by Russia and Iran and all the allies of Assad, who need to do everything in their power to ensure the Assad regime survives. How else do you think 2.5 years later the Assad regime is still there? It's no longer, as I mentioned, the functional government by any means. It controls 40% of the sovereign territory of Syria. The rest of it is controlled by different factions of the Free Syrian Army and other elements opposed to Assad. So at this point in time, I mentioned, and I think this is the best way to articulate it, the Assad regime currently stands as the best armed and funded militia with the biggest external support that is
No, it's my understanding that the Assad regime belongs to the Alawite faction of Islam. And now, how much does the religious divide between Sunni and Shiites factor into this equation, particularly since it's well known that Iran is predominantly a Shiite community country?
Sure. I think that what is described as a sectarian conflict in Syria, mostly by folks outside of Syria, is a desperate oversimplification to make sense of what's happening in the country. Yes, the Assad family are Alawites. Yes, the Assad regime has done everything over the past 40 years to ensure that those loyal to them are places of privilege and power in the country. And with that said, you know, at the beginning of the revolution, 70% of the officer corps in Syria, in the Syrian armed forces, were Alawites, for example. So it gives you a sense of how Assad has utilized not just his family to monopolize power, but also the fact that he comes from. But at the same time, over 70% of the country is Sunni and Arab, for example. And significant elements of the Assad regime and loyalists are Sunnis as well. So we can't necessarily define this conflict as a Sunni-Shia or Sunni-Alawi struggle. It's not. It's just like any struggle in the world, it comes down to a few things: power, money, resources, or access to resources, and control. And I think people utilize sectarianism to achieve goals, not necessarily sectarianism in its own right doesn't exist. Unless it's being, the flames of it are being fanned by whichever party wants to monopolize control.
Uh-huh. So it's really Syria has been a fairly secular country for many, many years. And unlike what's happening elsewhere in the Middle East, this is not a religious conflict. This is purely an economic, social conflict related to justice. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I think that's a very close assessment and well articulated. Rarely do you find any conflict in this world to be purely a religious conflict, and that must be said as in Syria as well. Syria isn't necessarily, in the classic sense, a secular country. It's an extremely conservative country. And if you look in terms of how Syria has been run, even with the Assad regime over the past 40 years, depending on the nature of what's happening in the country, they'll tip the scales of secularism to justify or not to justify their rule. And they'll basically create legislation or alter things in the country depending on who they want to appease and control at that moment. So, for example, there previously, I think, pre-March 15, 2011, which was the beginning of the Syrian revolution, there was a ban, for example, on niqabs. So right after that, when they saw that there was an uprising in the rural countryside, the Assad regime themselves lifted the ban. Now, does that mean that the Assad regime is a secular regime? No, it means that they're a pragmatist regime that does anything that they want to do to ensure that they can maintain control and suppress popular expression, popular uprising.
The conflict here in the West is, and you read the same newspaper as I do, has not given a very positive or a very optimistic picture of what would happen to Syria in a post-Assad regime. Is that an accurate description? I mean, are the rebels and the people fighting the Assad regime, do they have the ability to come together and form a government with the necessary support and cooperation amongst all those involved?
Sure. I think we've been bombarded in the West with this narrative that the Syrians themselves, who are in opposition to Assad, are, you know, basically ultra-conservative, ultra-right-wing, or can't come together, or, you know, just... We've seen the narratives of mainstream media in the West mirror the narratives of the Assad regime themselves, to discredit whatever opposition is going on. In the West, this occurs because it justifies the inaction of the West in the face of overwhelming atrocities and the documentation on social media, on YouTube, for everyone to see of these atrocities of the Assad regime. And so what we have in Syria is a really interesting dynamic where propaganda being pushed by Assad's allies finds its way and seeps its way into mainstream discourse here in America. For example, there was a clip, I think, in the intro of this where I think it was a congressman, correct me if I'm wrong, who stated that Al-Qaeda and the rebels should, basically are one and the same, insinuating they're one and the same, and that the Americans should not arm Al-Qaeda. Why would we after 9/11? And making real leaps in terms of connections, and which really is symbolic of two things. One is either utter ignorance as to what's happening on the ground in Syria, or two, a real political ploy to discredit an entire popular movement that has been fighting and struggling against overwhelming odds for a couple of years. Now, does that mean that there aren't divisions among those opposed to Assad? Of course there are. But we should never, ever look at the Syrian conflict as just as simple as those as rebels versus Assad. As we've seen, there are elements that have come in from the outside that have taken advantage of the vacuum in Syria, such as ultra-right extremists connected to Al-Qaeda. But those are in no means the people who are driving this revolution. These aren't the Syrian people who are trying to create a pluralistic society post-Assad that is driven in a nation that doesn't have sectarian privileges, that is driven in a nation that has equality for all, and so on and so on. Whereas we hear the narrative in the media here that kind of creates a connection and says all these people are one and the same. And that is not only absurd, but it's terrible. It's terrible propaganda in its own right.
What would it take for the rebels, the revolution, to succeed in finally overthrowing Assad? What are the key ingredients that you think are necessary?
Well, last year I articulated the formula, if you will, as very straightforward. It's once you get into the formula, it gets complicated. But the formula is we need to support civil resistance in Syria. This uprising, after all, is a popular uprising, a civilian uprising, where all walks of life basically said, no, not anymore. We cannot live in this state of affairs with the Assad regime there. Everything from strikes to boycotts to protests, this is the civil resistance that occurred day in, day out in Syria. We need to support that. Trust, we need to support the militarized resistance. Of course, when you see me bombing the capital of Damascus and destroying the infrastructure of an entire nation, we need to ensure that there's some sort of defense militarily against such a thing. So it's supporting civil resistance, supporting military resistance. Now, on its own, we've seen that with the overwhelming support the Assad regime gets from the outside, on its own, we know that the revolution needs support. And that's the third factor that's needed. There needs to be some sort of consistent support coming in from the outside with humanitarian aid and military aid, and that just hasn't happened this point. And that's why this revolution has been delayed. The outcome of overthrowing Assad has been pushed into the future. And really, we all know what it takes to finish this struggle. Like I said, we need to make sure that the Assad regime is removed. And it can be removed if there's a little bit of consistent support on behalf of the revolution. Now, one of the things specifically for over a year people have been calling for is providing vetted elements of the Free Syrian Army with anti-aircraft weapons. This entire struggle right now, from a military perspective, can be described as Assad militias going into areas after Assad's MiGs bomb and devastate those areas, and they perform sweeping operations on the ground. And so there is no revolutionary response to Assad's needs. And for over a year, they've been pleading with the world to allow the delivery of anti-aircraft weapons, which still, to this point, have not been consistently provided.
I see. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question here, but your work with the Arab American community here in the U.S.,
Sure.
Is there any connection? Is the Arab American community here in the U.S. able to affect or influence any of what's going on in Syria?
Sure. I mean, just in the absence of real political will and support for the revolution, in the absence of nations of the world doing everything they can to skirt their humanitarian responsibility, it's been ordinary people, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, Americans, period, who have been donating money and support to humanitarian aid efforts that have been helping Syrian people. Now, it's not enough, and it's never enough. We're talking about millions upon millions of people in desperate need who have fled their homes. However, the community here has done amazing things for raising millions of dollars in support so that people can actually gain some necessary things to live to that next day. We're talking about the basic humanitarian needs, water, milk for infants, sustenance, just to keep people alive. And the Arab American community has done a good job in mobilizing their networks to raise necessary funds. It's not enough. It's only a drop in the bucket in the big scheme of things. But in the absence, like I said, of national, international support, this is what people have been doing.
Before we go, Sarab, is there any place our listeners can go for information or to provide any support? Are there any websites or organizations that you'd want to mention?
Sure. There's actually, for one central area, people can go to my blog, actually, Sarabiani, Sarabiani.com. And there's a resource section there where you can find out how to get involved and provide humanitarian aid support to Syria relief efforts at this point in time.
Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Sarab.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yes, this was most enlightening. You take care.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Take care. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Okay, we have our next guest, Charlotte Cates, an activist and organizer in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement and also the social justice movements in Canada. She's on the organizing committee of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and works with the Boycott Israeli Apartheid Campaign in Vancouver. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so delighted you could join us. I know that while you were here in New York, in the United States, you've been very active in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. And now that you're up in Canada, you've have found a whole new community to work with. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing, and I'll let you take it from there.
Thank you so much. Well, in the United States, one thing that many people have come to realize is that one reason why the ongoing human rights abuses, occupation of Palestine, apartheid in Palestine, denial of Palestinian rights, including denying refugees the right of return, the building of settlements, the expulsion plans that are being drafted now against Palestinian Bedouins. One reason why these things are able to continue with seeming impunity by the Israeli government is because the U.S. government provides so much support financially, economically, politically, diplomatically, and militarily to the Israeli state. And so being in the U.S. and taking aim at what's happening in Palestine is actually addressing the crimes and the responsibility and the direct actions and involvement of the U.S. government in Palestine. And in Canada, while the Canadian government doesn't provide the military support and the financial support that the U.S. government does to Israel, the Canadian government, especially under the right-wing government of Stephen Harper, has been in the forefront internationally and on a diplomatic offensive in support of every action, no matter how egregious, no matter how much it violates international law of the Israeli state. While official Canadian foreign policy says, for example, that settlement building is illegal, John Baird, the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Canada, and other Canadian officials have spoken to Jewish National Fund, which is an Israeli state fund that purchases and holds Israeli land for the sole benefit of Jewish citizens of Israel and not Palestinians, and have, you know, talked about how Israel embodies their vision, have refrained from giving any word of criticism to Israeli settlements, and in fact, time and time again, have criticized any attempt by Palestinians, no matter how small, to hold Israel accountable. So here in Canada, just as much as in the U.S., looking at what is happening in Palestine is a responsibility. It's not just looking at something that's happening over there that's distant from what's happening here. These are the actions of our governments. And what our governments are doing are enabling the ongoing violation of Palestinian human rights. And so there is a very vibrant Palestine solidarity movement in Canada, much as there is in the U.S. And it's something that's really been growing in recent years. In 2005, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was going to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about the boycott movement, what they're doing, what their aim is, and what you ultimately hope to achieve through these movements.
Yes. In 2005, over 170 Palestinian civil society organizations issued a call to people of the world for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel. These can include anything from consumer boycotts of Israeli products to universities and investment funds divesting from corporations that sell weaponry to the Israeli military, or sanctions, as in canceling the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement that gives Israel special trade privileges, including for goods produced in illegal settlements in the West Bank on confiscated Palestinian land. And so the call was for when governments were not acting and were, in fact, not only silent on Israel's ongoing violation of Palestinian rights, but were, in fact, deeply complicit in them, that this was a call from Palestinian civil society, from women's organizations, student organizations, trade unions, and all of the major political parties in Palestine, to the people of the world through their civil society and through their grassroots actions, to hold Israel accountable politically and economically through the use of the boycott and through popular mobilization. And so what we've seen since 2005 has actually been a really dramatic growth in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Now, of course, before 2005, there were annual conferences of students talking about how to get universities to divest from the corporations that were building weaponry for the Israeli army, and how to and really looking at the example of Palestinians in the First Intifada, whose boycott of Israel inspired the world, and also looking at kind of other international examples like the boycott, the international boycott of apartheid South Africa, which was not just economic but also cultural boycott, academic boycott, refusing artists refusing to go perform in the sun city of today, Tel Aviv, until Israel recognizes fundamental Palestinian rights, recognizes the Palestinian refugees who have been expelled from their homes for over 65 years, the largest refugee population in the world, perhaps today second largest to the Syrian refugee population, but certainly the longest lasting ongoing refugee population, to return to their homes, that this is something that has to happen. It's not only enshrined in international law, it's a fundamental human right, that Israel has to end its occupation, its settlement building, its apartheid wall construction, and demolish these structures that were built solely to destroy and divide up Palestinian land, and recognize full equality for all of its citizens. Palestinian citizens of Israel, 20% of the country's citizens, are regularly denied equal rights by over 24 discriminatory laws. And we're seeing that again today where there's a plan that's called the Power Plan, where 30,000 to 80,000 Bedouin Palestinians in the Nakab Desert are basically facing the loss of over 800,000 dunams of land. So we're calling for these really fundamental things. Refugees have the right to return home. People have the right to be equal in their country, and there has to be an end to military occupation and apartheid. And we're boycotting Israel until it does those things, until it implements those actions, until it respects Palestinian human rights. And what we've seen over the past 8 years is that, you know, a number of institutions, including the European Parliament, have dropped their contracts with G4S, a company that is a massive security company, one of the largest in the world, but that provides security facilities for Israeli prisons that imprison Palestinian children, among 5,000 other Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners. What we've seen are major international artists like Roger Waters of Pink Floyd or writers like Alice Walker refusing to participate in Israeli institutions, in Israeli government-sponsored film festivals and lecture tours, or book publishing. And what we've seen is really growing campaigns that are springing up all across Canada, all across the U.S., and really all over the world in response to a call by Palestinians themselves saying, this is what we want people around the world to do. You do have power, and it's time to take action and do something about it. And one thing that you can do, that everybody can do, is boycott Israel, is work for divestment, is work for sanctions, is support academic and cultural boycott. Don't cross the global picket line that's been called for by Palestinians against Israeli apartheid.
You mentioned some notable successes in the cultural boycott. Are there other examples, say, on the economic side or political side that have given your group some real traction?
Sure. Well, what we've seen on the economic side has been, in particular, many students on campuses across the U.S. On multiple California campuses in the last semester have passed official divestment bills through their highest levels of student government, calling on their universities to divest from various corporations that are doing business with the Israeli military, including Lockheed Martin, General Electric, Elbit Systems, and other military contractors. And the results of those are going to the UC Regents right now. We've seen the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, the Canadian Union of Public Employees in Ontario sign on and officially endorse the boycott and work to divest their union funds. We've seen more and more student organizations here in Canada over the past year, seven major student government institutions representing tens of thousands of students have voted to implement economic boycott on their university's funds. So there are still struggles taking place there, but what we've seen is that the overwhelming majority of active students that are participating in student government and student unions in the U.S. and Canada are saying that, yes, boycotting Israel and boycotting the corporations that make occupation possible is a priority, and they want to see their universities implement that. We've seen Veolia, that's involved in the construction of a Jerusalem light rail project that involves confiscating Palestinian land and also providing transportation to illegal settlements, being cut out of the nominating process in London and other cities after sustained campaigns by human rights organizations. We've seen, in Europe, settlement produce being forced to be labeled that it was produced in illegal settlements. So there are a number of victories. In fact, the Palestinian Boycott National Committee, at their website at bdsmovement.net, has recently produced an interactive timeline of 8 years of the BDS movement, and it includes both economic and cultural and academic boycott victories and movements that have taken place over the past 8 years, and I highly recommend checking it out and also looking at that website for other information about what's happening everywhere in the world to support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel.
That's some pretty amazing work you've been able to accomplish. Charlotte, could you tell us a little bit about the Semadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network?
Sure. Well, one aspect of the struggle in Palestine that has actually gotten quite a bit of attention in the past year and a half or so has been the fact that mass imprisonment has been a huge aspect of the way in which Israel maintains its occupation and its control of Palestinian land and Palestinian lives. 40% of Palestinian men in the West Bank and Gaza have spent time in Israeli jails. It's an incredibly common experience. One out of every four Palestinians of both genders has spent time in Israeli jails. And so this is an experience that touches every Palestinian family. There's not one Palestinian family that doesn't have fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, and cousins that have spent time or are currently held in Israeli jails and detention. I mean, every single day there are reports of, oh, 5 people arrested overnight, 10 people arrested overnight. Even when people are held for just a short period of time, even when they're held and interrogated and then released, this experience of detention, of interrogation, of torture, of violence is something that pervades every Palestinian household. And so right now there are 5,200 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And one thing that's kind of come to the attention of people around the world is that they've engaged in a series of hunger strikes over the past year and a half. And, of course, they've also engaged in hunger strikes for decades going back beyond that. But calling for an end to administrative detention, which is the practice of holding Palestinians arbitrarily without charge, without trial, for six-month periods that are indefinitely renewable, for an end to solitary confinement and isolation. Family visits have been revoked, and prisoners have been fighting to get family visits back. And first and foremost, Palestinian prisoners are fighting for their freedom, but really the freedom of their homeland, which is why they're imprisoned in the first place. And so Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, which is on the web at Samadun, Samidoun.ca, provides news, information, and action alerts so that people can support the struggles of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. What we've seen is that Palestinian prisoners are on the front lines of the struggle. Every single day, they're confronting the occupation. They're just confronting it behind bars. And so Palestinian prisoners have, through their hunger strikes, through their steadfastness, through their kind of constant commitment to seeing a free Palestine, have been an inspiration for the Palestinian movement as a whole, and in much the same way as Nelson Mandela and his fellow political prisoners inspired the South African movement, as Bobby Sands and the courageous hunger strikers in Ireland inspired and really provided a light to the Irish struggle for freedom and liberation. Palestinian political prisoners do the same. And so what we do is we mobilize people, thousands of people, to respond to action alerts, to put pressure, to send emails, make phone calls, engage in demonstrations, and basically tell the Israeli state, the U.S. government, and the Canadian government that while these Palestinian prisoners may be locked up behind bars, there are people around the world that are watching their cases, that are paying attention, and that say that Israel is responsible for the lives and health of these prisoners, and we want to see them free, and we want to see an end to the mass imprisonment of the Palestinian people by the occupation, by Israeli apartheid, and in Israeli jails.
Ms. Cates, could you, before you leave, give our audience a web address that they can get more information and maybe help if they can?
Sure. Well, just a few addresses I can recommend. If folks are interested in getting involved in the Campaign for Cultural and Academic Boycott of Israel, I recommend visiting usacbi.org. That's the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott. And folks could also visit the Palestinian Campaign at pacbi.org. If folks are looking for more information on Palestinian prisoners, they can visit Samadun, Samidoun.ca. And if people are looking for more information on the boycott,
to visit bdsmovement.net or boycottisraeliapartheid.org.
Well, I have to say, Charlotte, this has been very, very interesting, and bravo. You know, you've gone beyond the political, and this is a social justice issue, and we wish you all the best going forward. We're going to have to move on at this point, but thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you, again, all the best.
Thank you for having me on today. It's been great to be part of the conversation.
Take care now.
Have a good evening.
Take care.
That was a wonderful interview. Next up, we have Moody Khalil, who is an artist, a doctor of arts, and he's traveled from his native Egypt here to the shores, and he has some important insight for us of the Egyptian situation. And here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dr. Moody Khalil. He is an artist and publisher from Egypt who is working these days. He's worked in Britain. He's working in America now. Dr. Khalil, welcome, sir, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me with you today.
Dr. Khalil, we've been following the events in Egypt, and I can't imagine that you're too terribly unhappy about what happened with the ouster of Morsi. Particularly what he was doing to the democratic process in Egypt. Would that be correct?
It was a disaster. Everything he has done is terrible. We got in more debt. We got in a terrible position with the countries around us, like everybody having fun at our president because he doesn't know how to speak. He doesn't know how to deal with the other countries. He's just jumping from a country to another to just try to get a loan from here, a loan from there. And actually, even the Egyptians like feel it's every single day it's worse than the day before, it was like a huge release for us after we kicked him out. So it was a big thing for everybody in Egypt. It was one of the greatest event happened in the history of Egypt.
I know you'll have more to say on the current situation, but do you think that the other factions, the more liberal factions in Egypt, will be able to put aside their differences with each other and come together and form a plurality to retake the government if elections are held again?
All the group is ready to communicate with each other except just only one group, which is Muslim Brotherhood. They're making a lot of trouble. They fighting back. They want to turn the country apart, threaten the government, threaten everybody by bombing and killing. And okay, if we didn't get the Morsi back, you will see blood everywhere. So everybody ready to communicate with each other, yes, except Muslim Brotherhood.
Dr. Khalil, let me ask you a question. I'd like to go back, pull back just a little bit. If you were to characterize the reasons for the initial ousting of Mr. Mubarak, and then characterize that, if you would, and contrast that with the reason that Mr. Morsi was ousted.
If we go back a little bit to Mubarak times, it was very peaceful time. We spent 30 years with no one fight. I'm not saying he was the best president, but I'm saying we had a lot of security. Security everywhere. You can walk in the street 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's very peaceful. Nobody can attack you. You will walk in the street very secured. Economy wasn't that great, but look, everywhere in the whole world, the economy is like struggling. So it's not about just only Egypt. It's everywhere. But after what happened on January 25th, 2011, and we got Morsi as a president, everything went down. Like, we have no security anymore. Some said, I guess this is a deadline for everybody to walk in the street. Yes, so there is a lot of people walk after that, but there is a lot of accidents. A lot of people killed everywhere in all the cities. Economy went down. Political, so bad. They have no idea how to deal with political at all, zero. They don't have the sense of, I don't know how to say this, but like, how to deal with the economy from outside and from inside. So actually, Morsi's time is so bad, and it didn't last a year because of all the bad things he did. And if you want to talk about the June 30 revolution, this is the first time you see 22 million of people standing in the street saying, we don't want you. Step down. For 3 days in a row, 22 million in the streets. And even Google Earth talk about it. They saw all this congregation in Cairo streets and around the presidential palace and Tahrir Square. No one saw this number of people. Like, Mubarak resigned when 4 to 5 million people was in the street. But this time, we have 22 million of people standing in the street. And this guy, he say, no, you elect me, I will stay. So there is no logical thinking in that position. He never listened to his own people. 22 million people asking you to leave. And he just, no, I'm not leaving. So here's the problem. We have a president, he never listened to his own people. He want to do whatever make him happy and his people happy, which is Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Hamas in Gaza. That's it.
Did you find during this time that minority rights were in jeopardy? If you weren't a Muslim, I mean, we hear so much about the oppressive rule of Islamist governments. Did you find this the case?
For what?
Well, for Islamist rulers and you know, the role of non-Muslims in society. Did you find there was oppression?
For if you're talking about the Coptic Egyptians, before at Mubarak times, yes, Coptic Egyptians left in peace. Not 100%, but I can say like over 90%. But in Morsi's time, no, not at all. It's all of them jeopardized their lives every single day. They have been killed every single day in Egypt. They bombed the churches everywhere around the country. So, no, there was no peace at all. Especially for the Christian Egyptian.
What is your sense as to what is going to happen now? You have the military in charge, and what we hear here in the press is that they are going to move towards restoring elections. Is that indeed the case?
First of all, I want to explain something very important, because that's what the Muslim Brotherhood trying to hide and trying to say it's a coup and the military did that, and this is very wrong. What's happened is revolution on June 30th, and what happened, 22 million of people went down in the streets and they asked Morsi to step down, and he refused to step down. So after the army saw that, and so a president who do not listen to his own people and all the people asking him to resign, and he's not listening. So they depositing him and put him under house arrest for the people, because the people decided to do that. They said, we want him out. So what the army did, he listened to what the people said. But the army didn't do that by his own, or like he just like everybody said, it's a coup. No, it's not. And whatever in charge right now, we have a president right now, and he's the one on the charge. Military is just only in the street for security. That's it. But he's not in a charge. He's just controlling security in the street. That's it. But for the election, yes, it's going to happen. They said it's probably going to be within a 6 months from now, after they write the constitution, after they get everybody together, they're going to start for the president election.
Obviously, Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood is not going to step aside quietly. And there's speculation that there could be civil war in Egypt. Do you see that as a possibility?
Probably they're not going to go easy, but it's not going to go to civil war, because Egypt is different than Syria, than Iran, than Afghanistan, because people in Egypt knows a lot of about political, and all of them, all the Egyptian, you have probably 90 million people live in Egypt, and what the Muslim Brotherhood, like 500,000. So, like, yes, they're making a trouble because all of them are terrorists. Having guns, having rifles, having bombs, like, yes, making problems, but that's not going to last forever. They're making a lot of trouble, but it's not going to last. So that's never going to happen in Egypt.
True. Dr. Khalil, let me ask you this question. If the minorities under Morsi were experienced increasing pressure and duress from the Islamic Brotherhood under Morsi, do you see this turning from what you hear talking to people still in Egypt? Are you seeing a decrease in that pressure? Is there greater equanimity in the minority communities? First, is it getting better? And two, what would you say is the Muslim Brotherhood ultimately, are they beginning to acquiesce in this, or do you think there's increased militancy?
It's very hard to decide that, but it seems like it's in between and back and forth. But there's something I want to mention here about, it's a very important thing. Whatever we are seeing here, and who's supporting Muslim Brotherhood? Who's supporting them right now, at right this minute? The American government. Because probably soon we're going to have a huge problem here in America because of what's happening in Egypt. Because what Obama administration did with the Egyptian administration, and this Watergate, and happened many, many years ago, it's probably happened again with Obama, because he has these secret deals with the Muslim Brotherhood to sell 40% of Sinai to Palestinians to live in it for $8 billion. And now they have a big problem, because now the Muslim Brotherhood do not exist anymore, and Obama administration, they don't know what to do, because they already pay $8 billion to Muslim Brotherhood to cut a piece of Sinai to give it to Palestinian. And now we feel like, all of us, like, what's going on? Is those people like selling our country? So that's why, because of Obama trying to cover all this mess he did, he's trying to support Muslim Brotherhood to get them back in power to cover himself.
You know, that's extraordinary. Is there evidence for that, or would you characterize that as speculation and rumor?
As my knowledge, there is a lot of evidence. It's under the army hands. They have a lot of paperwork, but definitely I'm speaking from my perspective. I'm speaking from what I hear from the news, from what I hear from my friends back in Egypt. So, and if you listen to Egyptian news, mm-hmm. you will hear them talking about that in the news, in the front of everybody. And if you notice, that U.S. embassy in Egypt doing a lot of work, contacting Muslim Brotherhood, talking back and forth, trying to make a peace between both of them. Why? There is a huge question there. So everything, when you look at the situation, you feel like Obama administration in a huge trouble, because they're having a huge problem right now with Morsi government and Muslim Brotherhood. That's why you can't get a clear anything from Obama. Today is, oh yeah, we're supporting the people in Egypt. Tomorrow, oh no, you shouldn't do that to Muslim Brotherhood. The day after, really, the people should decide what they want. Like every single day, they have different opinions because they don't know what to do. And I guess the Congress is going to do something about it very soon. So that's how I see this thing, because this Muslim Brotherhood making a lot of mess in Egypt, and the only supporter of Obama administration, Turkey, and Qatar, and all of them doing for the same purpose, supporting each other because they have the same goal.
This is quite extraordinary. This is not something that is knowledgeable in the press over here.
Yeah, they try to hide it. Everybody's trying to hide it. They don't want anybody to talk about it because it's going to be a huge, like a Watergate when it happened many years ago. To solve a Palestinian problem, Obama decided to buy a percentage of Egyptian land and pay $8 billion. And I'm very accurate about this number, because this number, everybody talk about this number. And they're going to sell 40% of Sinai to give it to Hamas and Palestinian people to live in it. And that's why Obama is fighting to get Morsi back.
Now that's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's been no coverage of anything like that in
Definitely.
The U.S. press.
Definitely. But ask anyone who speaks Arabic or he following Egyptian news or Middle East news. Definitely. They know about it 100%.
Now, Morsi's branch, the Mother Muslim Brotherhood, is that Sunni or Shia Muslims?
Sunni.
And if you could just tell us, Dr. Khalil, for the benefit of us here in the United States, Egypt has always had a sizable non-Muslim population. Could you give us some perspective on how large that is? The percentage of the Egyptian population that's Christian.
The number is not accurate, but it's kind of between 15 to 20%.
That is sizable,
mm-hmm.
indeed.
Yep, it's very huge.
Is there talk of a trial for Morsi?
What do you mean?
In other words, Mubarak was tried for his crimes during his administration, or do you think that from the military standpoint that he is ousted is enough? Or because I see there's some talk in the Egyptian press, at least the English language version, about there's some diplomatic efforts to try to get him released from custody.
Yeah, but the people will not allow that to happen. Never. Because definitely they will take him to the court. Definitely. Definitely. Because he does a lot of crime. A lot.
Dr. Khalil, can you give us some information on who the other political factions are in Egypt? Who is going to be contesting for power when you do have elections again? Who are these groups?
Most of these groups is there is no a certain group, but all of them liberal, and all of them is open-minded, and definitely all of them is going to like have elect just only one person or two person, because they don't want to have more than two people, because they don't want the votes go away. So right now they there is no names definitely for sure right now, but as I heard, it's like they planning to have just only one or probably two for next election. Say congratulations to Egypt. I'm so glad to see 22 million standing for their rights, and say we want you to stop doing this to our lovely country. And I'm so happy that the army respond to all these people, because we couldn't do it without the army. So it's a people revolution. It was an army coup, and I'm looking forward to see a great country and more cooperation with other countries around us in the Middle East and in the whole world, especially for with America.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
And this is most encouraging indeed. You've given us a wonderful perspective, and a very positive one indeed. And we certainly wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
In your new country.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate that you having me with you this morning, and I would love to, for more further any question, I would be more than happy to join you anytime.
Don't worry, there'll be an invitation on a regular basis. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
And now, Progressive News Network is going to bring you the voice of Dr. Khalid Al-Sahili, a professor of civil engineering in Nablus, Palestine. Dr. Al-Sahili. I'd like to introduce my good friend, Dr. Khalid Al-Sahili. Sir, could you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm glad I have a chance to speak on your show. It's been a long time since we had a good communication together, so it's a pleasure and an honor also. I'm a Palestinian living in the West Bank, city of Nablus, right now. I had a bachelor degree and a master's degree from Jordan in civil engineering, and I got a chance also to get a doctorate degree from the United States, Michigan State to be specific. And I had the pleasure of working in Miami, where I met my good friend Rick Spisak.
And my great honor as well.
Consulting firms there in the area of traffic and transportation engineering. I spent some 4 good years there. And then I decided to go back home and teach at the university where I am now, which is Al-Najah National University.
Let me ask you a couple questions about life in Palestine. Unfortunately, Americans typically get one side of the story and not a balanced one. Now, let me start off on the most positive note I can think of. You're being a civil engineer, Dr. Al-Sahili. There's obviously plenty of work for construction, I would think, between rehabilitation of structures and road building and that sort of thing. But at the same time, we understand that there's been Israeli blockades of construction materials. Is that still very bad, or is that decreased somewhat?
The conditions in Palestine is somewhat close to what you describe it. It's although there is a Palestinian national authority established after 1993, after the Oslo Accord, but which sort of autonomy, but in reality we're still very much controlled by the Israelis. All the perimeters of the cities, all the cities, major cities in the West Bank, and they're controlled by the Israelis, meaning they may be present, they may not be present. You know what? It's up to they choose to do whatever. You know, either present at the block, a blockage at the, or roadblock at the entrance of the city. At that time, they could, you know, check IDs, prevent cars, allow cars. It's totally at their discretion. That could happen. We had some rough times where our roads were totally closed and blocked, and you have to go through checkpoints and sometimes get permits to pass through. Fortunately, that period we're experiencing a different period. The roadblock is there, but the Israeli presence is not always there. I don't want to say freedom. We have little ease in movement. Movement is much easier than before, but it's not normal. You know, still I have to go through the roadblock, but it could be totally vacant, but I have to go through it. So it's a political message that we're still there and we can control your life if we choose to. I think that's a message, you know.
Thank you.
But in terms of the work, this whole situation, of course, affects the work opportunities. There are, in civil engineering in particular, there are better opportunities than other fields. But overall, they're not much. They're limited. But as you said, they're better. Civil engineering has better, you know, opportunities to offer. As you said, construction, roads, and, you know, buildings. Construction is a major industry in our country, so there is a share. In terms of material, it's all, again, the same situation as the roads, but we do not, in these days, experience much, boycotting or blockage on the construction material. But I understand in Gaza, they do have a different situation where some of the construction materials could be blocked.
I see. Back in November, the UN General Assembly voted in favor of a Palestinian state. Has that had any benefits, if nothing else, in morale for Palestinians in general, do you think?
So far, is nothing tangible, but this is up to political bodies to capitalize on this achievement to materialize some benefits for the Palestinians. But so far, it's just on the morale side more than anything else. We do, you know, some things that, again, it's not very substantial. On letterheads, instead of Palestinian National Authority, it's written State of Palestine. You know, this is just more of a morality, improve your morality more than any thing that's physical.
Is the university life much impacted by the political intransigence?
It could. I'm talking about my university.
Right.
University has managed to do very well within this volatile political environment, whether internally or with the Israelis. Other universities may not have managed, you know, the same.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, one of the remarkable things that the university did during the Israeli invasions on the West Bank, including the city of Nablus, where the university is, in 2002, where we had total Israeli troops presence on the ground, and we have continuous curfew for 4 months.
Oh my goodness.
So at the same time, the university managed to stay alive. even we had every 2, 3, 4 days, whatever the curfew is lifted, so students go back to their classes. And I had, for me, I was teaching a senior class, and probably 30, 40 students, I don't remember the exact number, and they were telling me, sir, I'm graduating. This is the only class I'm left, you know, I have left. So I need just to take the final exam and get the degree, and I have a work offer, and so on. So what I managed to do, every time there is a curfew left, because they were living in different cities and they cannot even come to the city of Nablus.
Sure.
I asked them, you know, just get yourselves together, bring 2, 3, 4, whatever number of students, and just come to the university. I hold the exam. And I had probably, I held 7 or 8 final exams for the same course. And one of them, one of my neighbors, he told me, my niece, she's getting married and her fiance is coming from the United States. He has only 2 weeks vacation, you know, and she needs to get the degree and she's taking a class with you. I said, well, bring her home. You know, we could hold the exam at home. And we did have that. So we managed, the university managed through, this is a very tough time. So now, of course, the situation is not as much as tough. We had even campus construction under the military presence. Every time the tanks come, the workers, they flee away, they escape. With the universe, when the tanks go away, they go back to work. And so that's a mouse and a cat game, as it said.
Sure, sure.
But it's a matter of survival, you know. You know, we survived it, and probably we'll continue to do the same.
Let me ask you a question that sort of tends a little broader afield. In America, like I said, we, you know, we have, for those of us that pay attention to the news, we have sort of a limited perspective. And I was wondering, the changes in Libya and Egypt, how do they look from a Palestinian perspective?
Well, in general, because Palestine throughout the recent history been experiencing revolution against aggression in various forms, so they, in general, Palestinians, aside by the public, whether the public of this country or that country, because the general sense is the public cannot be wrong, you know.
Uh-huh.
The government can be, but the public most probably not. This is in general.
Yeah.
And for the what's been referred to as the Arab Spring, mostly the Palestinians, mostly they support that, support the change, because probably not Palestinians, most Arab people, they're not satisfied with the current situation. They believe that there should be changes for the better.
Uh-huh.
And it was thought this, you know, this is one of the ways to do the change. But probably with the inherited history in each country that has experienced the change, you know, it's not a change, obviously, it's not that easy. A change also is a culture. So you need the culture of change to make the change. And that's something probably the people would still need to learn more, how to make the changes, and I believe this could be done gradually. What happened could be positive if the people used it wisely, and there are incidents in the Arab world that it's not happening very wisely.
Uh-huh.
I think probably the events in Egypt these days, one may look at it from different perspective.
Sure.
But from my personal perspective, I cannot claim that all Palestinians share the same view, but at least my point of view as Palestinian.
Sure.
And we kind of did experience something similar. I think that the idea of democratic, you know, election, it's great and wonderful, regardless who came into power. And we did experience that in 2005, I think, where there was a change in the government. Fatah was the leading, then Hamas came into power, and I thought this is good, not because Hamas came, because people said we don't want the style of the old style, we want the new style,
mm-hmm.
which means then the newly elected should, you know, prove himself that he's worthy of this, and the other party who did not want should work harder on themselves to improve their image and, you know, be better prepared for the next election. So
uh-huh.
overall, it should be good for the overall. But it did not happen that way. And probably that's what's happening in Egypt. I think the biggest victim is democracy. Obviously, the government of Morsi, or Morsi himself, did not do well in managing the country or running the country. But I thought it's too soon for him to be kicked out, but that's
mm-hmm.
probably, the Egyptians can express their opinion more than me. I'm just looking from the outside.
Sure, sure.
And I'm looking at from probably a philosophical point of view. I thought it's something great that there is a democratic election, and this is something that we should maintain throughout, not only in Egypt, and everywhere that we can. And that what happened recently, you know, probably not everybody started believing that democracy would be a good thing to do. You know, obviously it's not working, but I don't think so. It should be working.
Yeah.
So it still needs a lot of work, and a culture of change, you know, is something that it has to be learned by gradually by the people.
Well, let me ask you another question, and again, this is, bless you, sir, sort of a broad brush question. For many, many years, Syria seemed to have the support of a variety of different power centers, Western power, Middle Eastern power. But evidently, now there's been some kind of shift, and Mr. Assad seems to have lots of trouble and very few allies. I was wondering, what's the sense of that from your perspective? I mean, from a Palestinian perspective, obviously Syria looks very different to Palestinians than it does to those of us in the West who try to stay informed. What's the thinking on that? How did Assad? Where did his allies go? Why did that happen? Do you think
the Syrian situation is sort of a little delicate for Palestinians? We do have several refugees. I mean, a good number of Palestinian refugees, and on the official side, the Palestinian officials have to stay neutral for the benefit of the refugees, because they shouldn't be taking any sides anyway.
Right. If I'm taking you in a not a good direction, just let me know and we'll go to another question.
That's okay. On the public side, people's opinion, there are some people who are in general pro, let's say, in support of the Syrian ideas, and probably they still do under the current condition. My feeling, most of Palestinians are not in big favor of Syria to start with, as the government or a system, you know, regime. But now the situation is probably more complex than saying yes or no to this side or that side in Syria. It's what's happening in Syria, probably to me, is not very well understood. Uh-huh. At the beginning, I thought it's a public revolution against the government, which is, you know, understandable. But now there is so much killing, with the news showing that both parties are involved in these killings. So situation is getting more complex, and which party is right and which is wrong. I mean, and I think, to me, they're both Syrians. They have to care about the lives also.
Yeah.
And they didn't seem to care, either party. You don't see many people in much favor of this side or that side.
I see.
Now, because of the confusion, a lot of people are confused and they don't believe it's a true revolution. It's a revolution that is influenced by many parties, not one party, outside parties. So they're not sure whom to support.
One of the other questions that seems to bring up is, you know, again, those of us in the West that pay attention to Middle Eastern issues, you know, we've seen, whether you want to call it the Arab Spring or maybe you want to talk about turmoil in governments and the people calling out for democracy or at least a more responsive government, we've seen this go across the Middle East from Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and now Syria, if those are the same forces. There's a lot of speculation here, and I'm sure there's a lot of speculation everywhere, about unseen forces and an agenda beyond any one particular country. Is that the thinking over there? I mean, whether it be people who say it's the CIA behind things or the Saudis behind things, is there any thinking that there are forces trying to change the Middle East in some other direction?
Well, there are a lot of opinions about this. Probably people are divided whether it's a true people revolution or some external forces driving the events. And, you know, I don't know. I personally don't know. Sometimes I feel this way and sometimes I feel that way.
That sounds like a sensible point of view.
Depending on the events. And what now probably the feeling is that it's externally driven. It's getting more now than before with the events that's happening in as you mentioned, in Tunisia, Libya, and more particularly in Egypt these days, where it says, well, because there was sort of democracy, so they're not, people aren't given a chance, though, so it's externally driven. That's a conclusion that more people are getting at.
Thank you.
And I personally do not, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay.
But it changes good. Regardless, I think change was good.
Okay.
It was about time.
Let me ask you if I could trouble you to explain one more thing to me. Again, we've heard of Sunnis, we've heard of Shiites, but now we're hearing about a group called the Salafists. Is that a regional offshoot, or is that a separate entity? Can you tell us something about what Salafists are as opposed to Sunnis and Shiites, or is it a subgroup of one of those?
Salafists are our Sunni group. I don't want to say, you know, put words in my mouth that,
sure,
you know, harm, you know, or hurt, you know, I'm not sure, but probably they're more described, I don't know if it is true or not, but they're described as being more strict.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Probably that's how I can describe them. And they have been there for a long time. They have grounds in Saudi Arabia in general.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if they're linked to Al-Qaeda. I have no idea. Probably
sure.
not.
Sure.
So it's the group that has been growing lately on the political side.
Uh-huh.
And it goes back probably to your earlier question, whether this is all internal or external.
I see.
The same question is valid also for this, where I believe in many events, you know, these events are externally driven.
Uh-huh.
To say what that means, that, you know, the Sunni has been there all the time, the Shia has been there all the time, and as far as I know, things been manageable. I don't want to say good or bad, but manageable.
I see.
Now, why it at this time? It was even before Syrian events. Why? You know, it seems that with every now and then, you know, some group has to be to keep fighting.
Yeah.
Now it's a time for Sunni and Shia. It was in the past between the Druze and, I don't know, or the Maronite and the Sunnis. You know, it could happen between any two groups, but I don't think they're a constant struggle between two specific groups. It's just some groups alternating the fight.
Thank you so very much, my friend.
You're welcome.
You have a very good day and the best to your family.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that was Professor Khalid Al-Sahili, direct to you from Nablus, Palestine. And now, another very, very special correspondent tonight, Miss Emine Dilik, who is of Turkish heritage, and she's currently on her way moving to Spain. She's going to spend a year in Spain, and she publishes, among other things, a wonderful online magazine called Progressive Press. I urge you to check it out. And here she is talking about her perspective from a more Turkish-centric position. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome activist, journalist, human rights fighter, and publisher of Progressive Press, Ms. Emine Dilik. Emine, welcome.
Thank you.
We're so pleased to have you. You are such a wonderful person with so many unique connections across the globe. I know how hard you've worked for human rights across the globe, but I want to kind of focus in on what's going on in the Mideast, the Near East. What are you hearing in terms of, let's start with the Syrian turmoil, from friends in Turkey? Turkey borders Syria, a long border there. What are you hearing, dear?
Sure. Well, if you have been following what we're reporting in our magazine, Progressive Press, we've been reporting, and the local newspapers, you know, I translate them from Turkish to English and report it. And it's been long known that those refugee camps have been used as training grounds for the opposition forces. And originally, of course, it was the Free Syrian Army. But unfortunately, as it happens in every Middle Eastern conflict, more Islamist or more jihadist started to get involved with it, as Hezbollah, of course, started to support Assad. As a reaction to it, there were more Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups got into the problem. So the local Turkish people, the population of those little towns on the border where they're taking the brunt of the refugees, they were very uncomfortable with it. And what I was reading from the local regional newspapers were they were calling those people in the refugee camps not refugees, but jihadists. And people were saying, you know, we don't want this jihadist. And if you remember last year, there was a huge bombing in Reyhanlı, right on the border town of Turkey, and 40 people died in that bombing. And then there was accusations of, you know, Al-Qaeda-related people doing it just to get Turkey more involved in the conflict. So people on the border, the Turkish people, are very uncomfortable with the situation, and they don't like the idea of extremists and fundamentalists being trained in those camps, the refugee camps. They call them, you know, jihadist training camps. And they're accusing United States, Saudis, and Qatar, and Turkey supporting those trainings. And, of course, I mean, I imagine Turkish government has knowledge of this. And as we have reported, the CIA didn't confirm it, but there is a report a few months ago that the CIA has been training these opposition forces in camps in Lebanon, Turkey, and in the region wherever they have camps. CIA has been training them since last 2 years. So that once that came to the knowledge, LA Times actually reported it, and we have been reporting it because the people actually, when people live, you know, if you're able to follow the local news, because of the language, it's hard. Of course, I have an advantage of understanding what the local news are saying and reporting. It's a lot of you know, Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups are in those camps. So my last report on Progressive Press, we actually printed it, published it today. Al-Qaeda is about to announce an Islamic State in Syria. The Free Syrian Army claims that. It was reported by Ashkar al-Awsat, it's a newspaper, if I'm not mistaken, based in Lebanon. They interviewed this person from Free Syrian Army. And Free Syrian Army right now is fighting with Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-related groups in there. And then they're claiming that Al-Qaeda is about to announce an Islamic State in the northern areas of Syria. So that's becoming a huge mess over there. And there was a reaction, of course, in the United States. You know, when anytime when we get involved, we have a way of looking at the conflicts in the Middle East and everywhere in the world, actually, in terms of good guys and bad guys. You know, we say the media basically portrays it that way. Okay, there are good guys, and then the bad guys, they're fighting against the bad guys, and we're supporting the good guys, United States. And that's not always the case. Just like, as you know, what happened in Afghanistan with Mujahideen, when we decided to arm them, they turn into Taliban and partial Al-Qaeda, and now supposedly we're fighting with them. So very similar things are happening in Syria right now. There was a group called Al-Nusra, Jabhat al-Nusra, and it's an extremist Islamist group, and they're well known in the region in northern Syria, and they're affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and because they've been so organized and very disciplined, they've also been supporting the local people. They were providing basics like food, and they helped get the buses go back. You know, people were able to reopen their businesses. So they established a form of trust with the local people, even if the people themselves, you know, Syrians, do not agree with their ideology of, you know, an Islamic state. because they're in desperate need of security and safety and food, so they're kind of being quiet right now. But
sure.
I am really not sure if a full announcement, you know, if they announce a full Islamic State in northern Syria, how that would work out. It might backfire, because recently, just a few months ago, Al-Qaeda over there and Al-Qaeda-related other factions announced that women are supposed to be wearing the veil now, you know, the naqab, abaya, full cover. So they're kind of imposing these new laws of not using makeup, and men are not allowed to talk to women anymore on the streets. So people are uncomfortable with it. So, I mean, my heart really goes out to civilians in Syria, to be honest with you. They're kind of like that expression in English we have. They in a place, how does it go? They're in a hard and a rock.
Between a rock and a hard place.
Rock and a hard place, yeah. I mean, there is so much problems with security and safety that it is, in a way, like they're desperate for that. So they, whoever provides the safety at this point, they're willing to work with those groups, but that doesn't mean they, you know, accept the ideology of Al-Qaeda.
Sure,
and
somebody who's prepared to pay you who's got a real good hold on your motivation.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we have recorded the killing of the Free Syrian Army's commander mid-July, Al-Qaeda killed the commander Hamami and his brother just to, you know, kind of show off power, trying to show people that we are controlling the area. So basically, Free Syrian Army is saying that they want a secular government. They do not want a jihadist Islamic government. So the factions within Syria fighting with each other too, and then fighting with the Assad regime. So it is really a huge mess, and I don't know who we are supporting, who we are training, and if we are even helping. I don't know. So
Well, I want to thank you so much for your insight and sharing with us. I want to wish you every success in your transportation and your relocation across the sea. I hope from time to time you get a chance to do some European stories for us.
Sure, I would love that, absolutely.
Okay, and the greatest success with your publication, Progressive Press. It's a wonderful piece, and I urge everyone to read it regularly. It's a great magazine.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Miss Emily Dillick, who is the publisher of Progressive Press, an activist in her own right for years and years and years, women's rights, human rights, immigrant rights. She's just a phenomena of a person, and I hope you do check out Progressive Press. I do also want to mention our good colleagues, the Progressive Media, Ms. Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stead and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Ms. Susan Nylon with her show The Nylon Report, our friend and colleague Anita Stewart with her show Wise Women Media, and all those great progressive media people out there. So next up, we've got Dennis Campbell from the UK. He'll be speaking to us from Wales. His report is he's been tracking Egypt very, very closely. He has a wonderful book on Tahrir Square. And here he is, Mr. Dennis Campbell. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce international author, activist, publisher, host of Worldview on YouTube channel, publisher of UK Progressive, Mr. Dennis Campbell. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dennis, I know you have been following activities in Egypt very closely, and you have a tremendous book about the information that you received in real time during the first part of the Egyptian Revolution. Put that in context and give us the update of what you see going on now with this transition from Morsi to the new, I understand it's a judge now who's got the chief responsibility in Egypt.
Not only just a judge, he was appointed 2 days before the coup, for lack of a better word. I'm not sure it's truly a coup, but he became the head of the Supreme Court. And literally 2 days later was elevated to the role of president within the country. Let's go back a bit. In Egypt Unshackled is the book that I wrote. It talked mostly about the use of social media in the 18 days back in 2011, from the 25th of January when it started to the 11th of February when we had the resignation of President, Dictator, General, whatever, Mubarak. He'd been in control for 31 years of Egypt. The economy was in a shambles. The country had been through, you know, a series of basically riots over food. The average person made the equivalent of $2 a day, if they were lucky. Prices of staples such as bread and things like that were through the roof. And Mubarak faced a demographic time bomb inside of his country. The average age was under 30. And these people were not in the military elite, which had been propped up all the way back to Nasser, then followed by Anwar Sadat, then followed by Sadat's vice president when he was assassinated 33 years ago, Mubarak. Once the revolution was over, the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been an outlawed organization for 80-something years, I mean, they could not meet legally, saw an opportunity and seized it. And probably the best commentary I read about what happened in Egypt since the 18 days of the revolution is that Egyptians got what they wanted, not necessarily what they needed. And by putting a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in charge in an election that was boycotted by a huge percentage of the people there in Egypt, you ended up with a very small minority of the people basically electing the Muslim Brotherhood and the President Morsi into power. Once there, Egypt, a secular country of roughly 80 million people, and by secular I mean, yes, there are a number of Muslims, but there also were Coptic Christians, there were a number of religions. It was one of the few places in the world where Sunni and Shia actually somewhat got along. And it was a real hard right turn that Morsi took in terms of legislating. He got the constitution pushed through and was doing an awful lot to basically undo a lot of the changes that the folks had been trying to do on the in terms of reforms. The revolution had been led, for example, by a number of young people. They weren't exactly students. They started fighting against Mubarak when they were students 10 years earlier, but they reached a point where they'd had enough, and there was a very large percentage of women that were involved in the overthrow of Mubarak during those 18 days. And what you ended up with was a situation in which women were marginalized, pushed to the side, no longer a part of the dialogue, no longer a part of the government. And indeed, if you look at the increase in sexual assaults, particularly on the part of police forces and other pro-Morsi protesters, it went astronomically through the roof. They tried to crack down. The military has always played this very close to the vest and very shrewdly. They've managed to keep the goodwill of the people, despite them largely being the cause for a lot of the problems that they have. So it's really quite interesting, both during the 18 days back in 2011 and in the most recent overthrow of Morsi, the military played it very cannily, very coyly, straight down the middle and said, we will never fire on the people. So as was the case with Mubarak, Morsi did not have a military that was willing to follow his orders and basically fire on the people. So it's been an interesting time, and it's been one of those situations I look at, and when I try to compare it, I say to people who are critical and say that Egypt is falling apart, I basically say, no, they're going through what every revolution goes through. People seem to forget that the United States needed 11 years from 1776 to 1787 to finally have a constitution in place and settle things down. During that time, they had invasions by the British. They fought some mini wars and skirmishes. They had the Federalist Papers. They did have a structure, but there was a lot of unrest within the country during those 11 years. Once the Constitution was ratified in 1787, everything began to settle. Now, they've had their Constitution get thrown out, basically, with Morsi, but it's going to take a while, and this is a natural hiccup and a speed bump in the roadway.
I think you make an excellent point. What are you hearing about the reaction to this new judge who's been appointed? What are you hearing from your tweet circuits?
Well, not necessarily tweet circuits, but we had on our Worldview Show program, www.youtube.com/worldviewshow, last week we had Ahmed Tharwat. Now, Ahmed is based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he produces a television program called Beladan, which means with open arms. And he's been working very, very closely with Representative Keith Ellison, who's the only Muslim member of Congress, to help dispel a lot of the notions of the Muslim world that, you know, 99.99997% of the people in the Muslim religion are just as peacekeeping and, you know, care about their families, care about their community, as does 99.9997% of the Christian community.
Uh-huh.
You know, so and when the Christian community goes bad, they don the white masks, and we call them the KKK. Okay,
yep.
When the group here in the Muslim world go bad, and you know, decide to blow themselves up and wage war, we call them Al Qaeda. There is absolutely no difference in terms of the fringe nature of who they are. So when we had Ahmed on, we were talking a lot about whether either one of us thought this was going to result in a civil war. And it seems that what has happened is that while there were protests and while there was outrage at Morsi being removed, and there was indeed a counter-demonstration outside of the Interior Ministry secret police headquarters as well as the presidential palace, several thousand people showed up. It was nothing like the millions of people who showed up in Tahrir Square, in Cairo, in Alexandria, in all of the cities around the country, demanding a change, that the Muslim Brotherhood be thrown out, because they've been so busy trying to cement their power that they, you know, weren't governing and they weren't taking care of the big issues. Everything was reduced to a non-working theocracy. At this point, the jury is still out on where the Egyptian government is finally going to end up. At this point, no one is 100% certain what will actually happen there. It was extremely interesting that the attempted appointment of Mohammed al-Baradei, you may remember him as being the head of the atomic, the International Nuclear Atomic Agency, Energy Agency. I'm sorry, it's the IAEA.
Very good.
I can't get the acronym correctly.
Man knows his acronyms.
Yeah, the acronyms throw me. He was the head of that organization and very, very prominent during the search for weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, in Iraq. And he played a very huge role in trying to get the United States back in 2003 to just slow everything down a little bit. And he was unsuccessful, but he did end up sharing in the Nobel Peace Prize that year. So he very well respected outside of Egypt. Inside of Egypt, during the 11 days of the uprising in 2011, he was mocked and ridiculed. Basically, he showed up and was placed under house arrest by Mubarak because there were fears that he was going to become the opposition leader. Well, that didn't work out. I mean, indeed, the students that actually ran the uprising and the people that caused the uprising were quite upset that this guy thought he could just sort of walk in and do whatever he felt like and was going to end up leading after this was over. He was sort of in the catbird seat when General Sisi, who was the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, they're the ones that actually run the country on a day-to-day basis, they pegged him as well as they had the Coptic Pope, his name escapes at the moment, they had other Muslim leaders. And during this coup, they were the ones that we saw on television actually saying, you know, we're going to be taking care of things and running things. Once again, the opposition to Albarradé came not this time from the left, but from the right. And there is a lot of quiet maneuvering and work being done by this new president to really take a much harder look at making sure that they get the governing piece of this right. You know, Obama has had a hands-off sort of situation on Egypt because it looks as though it's going in the direction it needs to, where a very large coalition of people are trying to come together. The real problem remains, will the army back away? Because those generals control about 40% of the businesses, and when the billions of dollars of U.S. aid comes into the country and goes out in the form of arms and arms sales and deals, a lot of that lines the pockets of these generals.
You know, it seems to me that the coverage has been, as is too typical here, you know, more about some of the more photographic and scandalous aspects of this this new change. You know, we've heard about the roving rape squads. You know, we hear speculation about the military. Do you think, since the military has taken a hand again, and they are such an economic force in the country, do you think that this is going to mean economic improvements for the average Egyptian, since that big economic power center now seems to have re-usurped power? Has there been any economic improvement with this new change yet?
No, and that's the issue. I mean, that's, you know, ultimately what happens, and we've got a piece up tonight on the climate change. We've been talking. I interviewed Robert Hunziker, based in Los Angeles, but he's a climate change journalist. And one of the things we spent a lot of time talking about is the notion of food riots that are going to be coming as a result of climate change. And he talked at length about the studies that are being done by the Jet Propulsion Lab of the amount of methane being released up in the Arctic Circle, and how drastic a change this has become in the globe's food-growing areas. And what we're seeing is that even in countries like Syria, which was the breadbasket of the Middle East with the current strife and everything there, people are going starving. You know, there's a very real possibility that even places like China and India are going to be starving as the last 20% of the glaciers melt. The methane is 100 times more lethal than CO2, which is what we're worried about. And there are literally parts of the Arctic Ocean now, because they don't have ice cover, where it's bubbling up into the ocean. And the Army and others are involved in this study where they actually call them flying in the mud. They fly 500 feet above ground taking readings as part of a five-year-long study. And they're seeing alarming amounts of methane being released into the atmosphere. The reason I went where I did is that they can't grow enough food in Egypt right now to feed themselves. Most of the arable parts of Africa are suffering under crippling drought. Most of the arable parts of the Middle East are suffering under crippling drought. You know, we're in the midst of a heat wave here in the United Kingdom, the likes of which none of us have seen in some time. We're on our fourth week in a row, no end in sight of, 80-plus degree temperatures. While it's very, very nice to have 80 to 90 degree temperatures, you've heard the song about mad dogs and Englishmen not going out in the noonday sun. They're dropping like flies here. You've seen the Open Championship golf on your television screens, and they're playing on sun-baked courses in Scotland, where every time they contest it, even the golfers were saying, yeah, when we pack to come to Scotland, we pack extra jumpers, we pack two sets of waterproofs, we pack all sorts of things that we're going to need to keep ourselves warm and keep ourselves free from the elements. They're worried about the greens baking. So the reason I'm bringing climate change into this is that nobody is addressing the issue of climate change and what it's meaning in the Egyptian revolution, because the first revolution was as much about food and economics as it was about Mubarak. When your belly's empty and you're hungry and you don't see prospects of getting either a job or food, it only gets worse. So that's what's really driving a lot of what you're seeing.
From your contacts, what are you hearing also? I understand that Egyptians Morsi was very close to Erdogan in Turkey. Do you hear anything in terms of whether it be Erdogan has had his own dance with Islam, and it's a secular state, so Islam doesn't have that much power. Do you think now with the loss of Morsi there, that may have an impact on the Muslim power, so to speak, in Turkey?
It's not just Turkey, Rick. It's the player and the big instigator and the big troublemaker throughout that entire region is Iran. And Iran is posing an enormous problem for everybody, particularly when you look at Turkey, you know, and you look at what's been going on with the Kurdish population that doesn't get along with the Turkish government up in Kurdistan, or what used to be Kurdistan, but is part of Iraq. The Iranian border is such a porous border for instigators to move across into Lebanon, into Syria, into even as far south as Egypt. And they are relishing their role as global instigators. And they are the ones that are causing, because when you talk Sunni-Shia fights, that is where the basis of it is actually happening from. You look at what's gone on in Iraq since the U.S. pulled out. It's all Sunni v. Shia. So you've got a state of, for lack of a better word, pending civil war for years of atrocities against both sides that are bubbling up, and they're not respecting national borders. And so when you have somebody like Erdogan having problems now, that is a piece of it, but it's also economic. It's also, you know, what's going to happen to the food supply there. I mean, you can't have temperatures of 50 degrees, so it's 120 plus, you know, across that entire peninsula and grow crops. You can't, you know, even in Greece, even in parts of southern Italy, you have places that are literally burning up. So what are you going to do?
You know, it seems to me that this instability across the Middle Eastern countries, there's talk of some hands involved. Iran is spoken of, Saudi Arabia is spoken of, Qatar is spoken of, in terms of underwriting some of this radicalism. So let's say, you know, you've got the Iran on the one side, and you've got the Saudi Wahhabis on the other side. With these forces at play, who's winning? If that's it sounds like in a way a silly question, but they've been contending over this for quite some time in supporting, you know, radical elements. Do you see progress being made on either side?
Not really, because you've got centuries, millennial old battles going on in this area. You know, you're not talking a logical Western frame of mind in this part of the world. You know, you're talking a very tribal, very theocratic-based system where people are literally just trying to make certain that their side wins at any cost. It's not even a situation where the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Everybody's my enemy, other than the people to whom I have a close relationship with. And this is, you know, this is something that the United States, the United Kingdom, the EU, most of the Commonwealth nations have sown through 100 plus years of foreign policy, you know, where it's divide and conquer. It's a foreign policy where we've never treated anybody in that region as anything other than someone to be pushed around to get their oil.
Thank you so much, Dennis. You're always an erudite guest, and I can't thank you enough for joining us. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.